This podcast was founded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our deepest respects to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners and elders past, present and emerging. We honour and celebrate the contributions of the oldest living civilization to art and storytelling.
We all misbehave sometimes, want to change the world. Indulge in some bad behavior.
Hello, and welcome to Bad Behavior, the show for rebellious spirits unafraid to tackle the taboo. I'm Rosalind.
And I'm Nicola.
Woohoo! Welcome to another episode. How are you going, Nikki?
I'm so good. I'm very ready.
I kind of have a sneaky little question for you that's relevant to the topic today. And I just thought, let's be sneaky cheeky, right?
Hit me with it. I want to hear.
Okay. Today we're talking about intimacy on set. We're talking about intimacy coordination, how people do sex scenes on film and stage, all of that juicy, juicy stuff. So interesting. So excited. Do you have a sex scene or an intimate scene that had a really big impact on you in your life?
Like, there's certainly ones that I've seen where I'm like, oh, a woman wrote this, or, you know, someone was advocating for like the female gaze in this sex scene, for sure. I think that's so obvious from the first moment a sex scene happens. You can tell, you know, who's written it, who's directed it. Like, those types of boundaries are super clear to me as a viewer. But I think ones that I really enjoy are, which ones have I really liked? The first one that comes to mind is, do you know the scene from Atonement with Keira Knightley?
Oh, at the bookshelf and the green dress?
James McAvoy. That is an iconic one. I really like that. It definitely confused me a little bit, just like the aerodynamics of it all are a bit off. Like, I feel like it wouldn't happen like that at all.
Zero gravity moment.
Yeah, Keira Knightley is just a wisp of air in that scene, but she looks so good, and that green dress. And then I think the other ones that I really liked are all from gay films. Like, you know, when we speak about sex scenes, I think it speaks to the fact that you and I would like watch gay films together when we were in middle school as like a thinking that we were arty and chic, but really we were just super gay and looking for some answers. But like,
yeah,
those are the scenes that stand out to me, like the ones with representation. Like, I have my favorite ones from the L Word. There's this movie that Rosalind and I love called Guys and Balls. It's this German gay film. I would highly recommend it. And there's a scene in an elevator. The storyline's beautiful. The characters are beautiful. And the sex scenes are beautiful.
There's also an extended cut on YouTube that I think, Nicola, you've probably watched 100 times.
Oh, the extended cut. I have perused.
I kind of had an agenda when I asked you, because I think that there definitely are for me. And they're all gay. And it was because it was all of these scenes that were treated as intimate moments between two people rather than a porn category. Like, I got so sick of movies where having two lesbian characters having sex was this really like gratuitous like moment, and they were sort of like slipping and sliding on each other and like things happening. You're like, anatomically, what's happening? Are they enjoying it? Like, what is going on? It just felt so othered.
And the POV is off too.
Some random man is running that camera who has no idea about lesbian sex or women in general.
Has never managed to give a woman an orgasm in their life.
Well, they certainly haven't managed to give a woman an orgasm as a woman, because it's very clear they don't know entirely, like, anatomically how that even works, you know? Some of the ones that I think of are not sex at all. They're just, like, intimate moments, like the first kiss. Oh, I love a first kiss, you know? Like, the music, like, rises and the shot yes. gets a bit closer and, like, all of this stuff is happening and there's some heavy breathing and then suddenly there. Oh, I love it. I love it so much. One of my favorite all-time lesbian relationships as a teenager was Skins, Naomi and Emily. They definitely were part of my sexual awakening, you know, I'm with her, grabs hand, walks out. Ah, beautiful moment. Beautiful moment.
We're in the forest on the bloody picnic blanket. Oh, that was something else. That scene stuck with me. Oh, that was so gorgeous.
Guys, I don't know how to say this, but we're talking to Ida O'Brien today. Ida is an incredible woman. She basically pioneered intimacy coordinating. She really worked really hard on the intimacy on set guidelines, working with a number of different collaborators, but she has really pushed this incredible envelope that really was necessary. And once you learn more about it, you realize it's so obvious that it's necessary. So let's jump right in. I'm so excited for this one.
I am an intimacy coordinator and, well, actually my background is as a movement director and an actor and a dancer. That's my journey in this profession. As an intimacy coordinator, we are practitioners who bring best practice to a whole production, be it theatre, TV or film. So we're supporting the producer to put in place best practice and a professional process with the intimate content. We're supporting the director to be able to listen to their vision for the intimate content and then a clear process through which to journey in order to create that. Speak to the actors, finding out their requirements, and that's regarding nudity, similar to sexual content and touch, so that everything is known, the actors are able to speak about what's okay for them and most importantly what's not okay for them, and for that to be listened to and heard so that they can feel respected and empowered, so that nothing's going to be asked of them that's outside of their boundaries. And then we work with all the different practitioners to support that, like the wardrobe, makeup, first AD, DOP, director of photography, sound, to make sure that everybody is ready. We put in place a rehearsal so that, be it getting it up on stage or getting it in front of the camera for TV or film, that that process has been journeyed through in a professional way with clear choreography. So it allows everybody to serve the writing, serve the director's vision, have best practice, and at the end of the day, create the best intimate content for the production.
Incredible. What is the difference between a set that hasn't got an intimacy coordinator and a set that does?
Well, before the role of the intimacy coordinator and the intimacy on set guidelines, there was a void, and without a professional structure and process to go through in order to engage with the intimate content was like the elephant in the room. It was the thing that wasn't spoken about. Embarrassment very often. I mean, there are cases where producers or directors that are historic and out there in the press have used the intimate content in order to be predatory or abusive. But most of the time, it was just people were embarrassed to talk about the intimate content openly, clearly, professionally, and certainly not artistically, because there wasn't that forum to do that. And so in that void, it was left, the wardrobe department invariably sort of soaked up that preparation, because they're the ones that have to prepare the different modesty garments, so they'd be on that. But it would sort of be a conversation with them and the actor. It would probably be the day on set that the director would go, okay, this is the scene, this is what I want, why don't you two go away and work it out for yourselves? So that's where you've got these two actors who've listened to the director, who are trying their best in order to put in place the intimate content in the best way they can, where they're trying to simultaneously take care of themselves, take care of each other personally, and then create something that's right for the scene. But of course, in that scenario, it's not professional. You know, that thing of, okay, let's just do it in one. Like, deep breath, close your eyes, let's just do it in that, you know, unconscious, no breathing, just let's get it over because it's the worst thing possible way. And you can see in that scenario, there's no way that anybody can really bring artistry, bring presence, bring consciousness, bring detail, bring beauty, bring, you know, serving of character. And and that's how historically it has been done.
I feel like it's one of those things where once you hear about it, it seems so obvious that you need it. It's just essential, because otherwise it's not really acting at that point, is it?
That's exactly right. And yet the bizarre thing is this idea of, oh, but there's got to be chemistry. We've got to make sure that these kids really fancy each other. You know, I've had people telling me in theatre that the director said to them, oh, we're going to do the intimate scenes tomorrow. Why don't you two go out and have lunch together? You know, and it's like who they are personally has got nothing to do with what they can bring professionally. The other aspect is that as human beings, we are sexual beings. You know, our fundamental life things are, you know, procreation and survival. So in that sense, we all have sex. So that's not something that we need a practitioner to come and choreograph. But however, we don't all know how to do a tango, so of course we're going to bring in a choreographer. We don't all know how to pretend to do a fight. You know, we can't have someone's nose ending up halfway across their face, so of course we're going to need a fight director or a stunt coordinator. But because of that thing of, well, we all have sex, then there wasn't that sense that we need a practitioner who has body skills, who has choreographic skills, in order to be able to choreograph this moment. The idea that it is a dance, it is a body dance, just the same as choreographing a waltz or a tango or a fight or a stunt. You know, it needs equally that careful choreography.
A lot of people think that having really blatant, controversial sex scenes or like full frontal nudity or all of those things are the things that are pushing the boundaries of film and society and ideas. And in some cases, perhaps in context, that does, because it's about vulnerability or it's about their context in society or whatever it is. But nudity is not inherently controversial. It's not at all true. And then you've got this idea that that's like the thing that's pushing boundaries in the world. And so, you know, Ita speaks on how it used to be that people would just throw actors into these situations because everyone knows how to have sex. And so everyone should know how to do this. And we're trying to make a film here and we're pushing the boundaries of what's okay and what isn't, and just go and get it done. And putting people in really vulnerable situations. And so I was thinking about it because I think that's true with so many things, that people will go, we want to push the envelope here. We want to make sure we're seeming really woke and well-informed. And so we're just going to go straight to the sensational and straight to the full-on taboo. And I feel like with bad behavior, we sometimes talk about really taboo, really sensational topics. And it's a really important thing to say when you're trying to push the boundaries of these really difficult conversations, it's important that you're not pushing the boundaries of specific people having them.
That's a really intriguing topic to think about, like what's just done for sensational sake versus what actually has intention. I was just thinking that as an actor, that must be so terrifying, like to be in that situation where you're just, it's assumed knowledge, like your boundaries are just assumed, no one's had a conversation, you don't know the person that you're necessarily in this particular scene with. Like, that is absolutely terrifying. And I'm sure it's led to a lot of traumatized people. It's no coincidence that in Hollywood, these actors and actresses and all these like prominent people, you know, it's no coincidence that bloody Me Too ripped through most of that demographic so intensely.
Yeah, absolutely. So boundaries are always going to be the thing that you need to talk about. I think people sometimes think a boundary means that you can't do what you want to do. Like, we have this intention, but you have that boundary, and so you're stopping me doing what I want. And the biggest thing that Ida has been saying is that that's not at all true. It actually makes it safer and easier to work in that space because you're taking all of that emotional angst out of it and laying it out in a really simple way and going, this is okay, this kind of touch is okay, we're talking about this in the context, this is the impact the scene needs to have, this is what the characters are doing. It's not about the actors themselves anymore, it's about the intention, it's about the acting. And so they can say, I'm not okay doing this, but this is the intention, so how about we do this?
Other ways to do a good job, you know, like there are ways to do a really great sex scene while also prioritizing people's comfort and safety. And like, it speaks for itself, honestly. Like, it really, the results of Ida's work, 100%. Like, I remember watching Normal People and being stunned by those sex scenes. They were so beautiful. They were awkward. They were gentle and they were sexy. Like, it was really sexy and you could like sense the chemistry between these two people. But it was because you know, I imagine those conversations about safety had happened and it was like so well choreographed.
Yeah. You know how good chemistry is when you trust that someone's not going to like do something you don't want them to do? Like, that's chemistry. But it's also the other way. It also works the other way, where it's if you're playing someone, for example, you know, we talk about this with Ida a little bit later on, but if you're playing someone who is violent and having a scene that's really integral to the plot, you know, maybe sexual abuse, whatever it is, if you're playing that character, the perpetrator, you need to have these guidelines. You need to know exactly what is okay with the other actor. You need them to understand that this is acting, that there are boundaries here, that you'll stop as soon as it's uncomfortable, so that when you go home, you're not looking back and going, oh my God, I just abused someone at work today. You know, you're going, I acted out a scene with my partner with full consent and understanding of why, how, and we stopped and we checked in and it wasn't me doing this thing to somebody. And I think that that's so relevant, not just to like film and theater, it's so relevant in life as well. Like, there's so many learnings from that. It's like, if you can set your boundaries and be really clear about them and understand them and self-aware with them, you can push further because you know where your limits are, you know what's not okay, and you know what you're challenging. You're not challenging your safety. You're not challenging, like, pushing yourself to an extreme where you're feeling completely unsafe and triggered. You're pushing yourself to a point where you're going, this is what I'm communicating, this is where I'm at. Like, there's something really, really powerful, I think, in that idea, just as an idea.
It's just the power of intention, isn't it? Like, it really is quite a powerful moment.
Absolutely.
You could have a situation, if you haven't considered it, where you've got, you know, either a heterosexual sex scene, you've got a single woman with a man sort of on top of her with nothing but a male crew, a male gaze. Yes, very often historically, you know, our crews are fundamentally men, and particularly with, you know, a lesbian sex scene, again, two women with nothing but a male gaze, and that energy dynamic can be really confronting and make your performers very vulnerable. So considering gender parity in a crew, but that you can't just, you know, conjure that up, you know, in a day. That needs to be considered, because also you want to keep everybody safe by having the best practitioners in the role. So that needs to be considered in early days. And then to put that in practice on sex education, that was part of what I spoke about with John Jennings and Ben Taylor right from the get-go, was they'd already considered that gender parity in the crew, and the third AD was a really experienced practitioner, and she then was held the set as the first AD, and we made sure that they had female boom operators for the sound as much as possible, not for every block, but for quite a few blocks they had female directors of photography. So that was already considered, and it worked really well.
You mentioning the LGBT stuff is really interesting, because I've had so many conversations with people about how frustrating it is when you watch a movie and then you get to a sex scene between two women, you're like, great. You can tell it was men, because it's just gratuitous, that it's just like lesbian becomes more of a porn category than it becomes an identity, you know? And you're just like, what are we doing here? How does this do anything?
Gentleman Jack.
I did, and I loved it.
So there, we worked really hard. Do you know this book?
No.
It's a really good book. And for those that are wondering, this is the whole lesbian sex book. A Passionate Guide for All of Us by Felice Newman. So that was one of the books that I got in research. And then, of course, all read a whole load of Anne Lister's diaries. And we spoke at length with the most amazing expert historian on Anne Lister, a lady called Anne Schomer. So that was a big, big focus for all of us. And it was really lovely when I first came and shared the work with the cast of Gentleman Jack. We had obviously Sally Wainwright and Choma and the director of the second block and all the actresses in season one who are going to play any of the intimate content. Again, speaking about making sure that we honoured, you know, a queer lesbian journey through, and because of course so much of it is actually not just about the sex, but about the emotional and psychological connection through then that intimate moment. And making sure that we got that physical storytelling, that we honoured the queer community and made sure we got it right. And I go, yes, it's been lovely receiving the response of the queer community, other than them saying that Saran Jones' nails were too long.
It's really interesting to hear about the journey that this industry has had, because it's a version of activism, isn't it? It's had so many ripple effects, and the idea that people will go into a set and consider a queer lens or consider a lens of something that's outside of societal norm, you know, it's, I'd put that in quotation points, but it's just that ripple effect is not going to happen until you actually go in with intention and really consider and carefully construct the boundaries and the guidelines. So it's really great to hear about how that all developed.
It was incredibly a completely organic, you know, journey.
Yeah.
And I'm as amazed as anybody at where I've ended up, but I'm also completely delighted and keep on being humbled and taken aback by the things you've spoken about, by just that intention of working well, putting in place best practice, the impact and the ripple effects it has had.
Talking to Ida about the effect that her work on intimacy coordination and the intimacy on set guidelines have had, because it has ripple effects beyond just setting a guideline for sex scenes. And some of the things that she was mentioning was really, really great, such as, you know, people feeling empowered, the LGBT community, for example, queer women watching scenes and going, I feel represented by this, rather than I feel exploited by this. It's just this like sensational moment for guys to be like, oh, that's so hot. Black gay men who are seeing this and going, oh my gosh, that's me. There's intersectionality to this. They've actually thought about the different layers. It's not just a hot moment. There's also a lot of other societal things at play. As we mentioned before, like understanding that you can show scenes of abuse in movies and not have to abuse the actors themselves. There are ways to make sure that the intention is clear rather than just exploiting people in order to make a show. Actually, she mentioned that she had a school kid write to her and say that episode 2 of Normal People was used in their sex ed class as a really great example of asking for continuous consent, because the kids just wanted a practical example where it wasn't, you know, this is what you ask. It was just, look, it doesn't have to be, you know, this really awkward thing. It can just be checking in. And that was really beautiful to know that that was there. And just so many other things, like as we were talking about the gender equity on set and all of the different pieces of this puzzle that can be explored, because you're actually being intentional and you're using this as the conversation starter, is so cool. And it's so interesting because activism was not the point. I mean, it was a version of activism because it was trying to help people. But all of this other stuff, you know, the ripple effects of that was not the point of the guidelines.
Yeah.
And yet they have such a bigger reach than just helping actors.
Doesn't surprise me at all. I think the impact is profound because it is profound, you know, like there's such like autonomy and power, and it's an incredible form of activism to be able to change how people see sex portrayed in various forms of media. Like, I think we underestimate the impact of that a lot, and how much watching sex in TV and films can really like change parts of our identity, or can change like how we view our own pleasure, you know, like it's massively transformative.
Obviously, while you're working with actors, you often, because it is a part of the story and you are making something that is, you're creating the storyline of something, you would have to occasionally deal with really intense, difficult scenes that might be, you know, abuse or have power dynamics or anything like that. How do you navigate that more intense space?
So if it's, you know, the idea of the risk assessment, part of the risk is, you know, what degree of nudity, what degree of simulated sexual content, but what's the emotional content as well? So absolutely, when there's challenging or abusive scenes, just like, you know, acknowledging that, clocking that. I'm very clear as a practitioner that I can facilitate and check out where someone's at. You know, they might share with me aspects in their lives that might be activating or triggering for them. Or so it might be something that's known to that particular performer. And also not just a performer, it could be a director that's working with this content, or the DOP, or anybody in the crew. So it's having a forum to go, this is the content. And like I say, I can facilitate and support, but you know, to have really good skills in order to be able to then support someone emotionally and psychologically if they are activated is outside of my skills. And that's where I co-work with an artist wellbeing practitioner. I co-work with a lady called Louise Platt, and I brought her in to my R&D when I was doing exploring the piece of work that ended up being part of the you know, the guidelines in 2015. And so, yeah, so I identify the risk and then say, this is who I co-work with. And then in the choreographing of, you know, particularly challenging content, it's even more important that you are given time to rehearse. And you rehearse really just pure nuts and bolts, the bare bones of choreography, and either co-working with a fight director or a stunt coordinator, be it in theatre or TV and film. So you're making sure that if someone is grabbed, that the person who is grabbing isn't the one that's got the energy, that one, the person who's being grabbed is controlling the energy. So you'd have the person who's grabbing just to hold the frame and hold tension in their own body, and then the person who's being grabbed can control that. So it looks right, but the person who is acting, the one who's the victim, has complete control. Also putting in place a timeout word so that the performers have the autonomy to halt the action, even more important in challenging content. And then I would make sure that we have that physical choreography really anchored, really clear, really, you know, in the actors' bodies, so that when you then go into the performance of it, in bringing in the emotional and psychological energy of the perpetrator and the victim, that that the actors personally feel safe, so they can really go there character-wise, and you know, giving that emotional and psychological, yeah, sort of storytelling. And then even more important at the end of the day, making sure that we honour everybody and really sort of, you know, put in place techniques to step back away from that character, honouring what they've given and then coming back to self. Really important.
I'm really passionate about, and I have my own views on this, I want to know what you think about abuse on film and TV, like violence against women and how it's portrayed. And my gut reaction is that, like, most of the time it shouldn't ever. Like, I feel like Hollywood has completely exhausted the amount of, like, violence against women that should have ever been shown in TV and movies. Like, I just have no faith that part of it is ever going to be able to be intentional. Those are my thoughts on that in particular.
Well, it depends, I think, because it's like we were saying, it's all about the perspective and the conversation that you're having and the intention of the scene and the context of the scene, especially if you're talking historical context. If you're doing things from perspective of people of color, you may come across slavery or abuse in that sense, and they might want to touch on it in some way. But you're right. Like, if it's in any way gratuitous, in any way, oh, they were abused, so we should show that, then no, it shouldn't be done. It should be implied. So I May Destroy You with Michaela Coel really touched on abuse and exploitation. And she dedicated her BAFTA win to Ida O'Brien because she was talking about how you can explore exploitation and abuse without perpetrating exploitation and abuse. And I think in that very specific context of people using a specific lens and making sure that the perspective that is told is from that lens and is not othering that lens, you know, it's not like some random white guy saying, we need to get you beat up because it makes sense in the story, then I see the point of it. Again, it comes back to intention, and it comes back to that conversation of, are we doing this because it's necessary to the plot? Or are we doing this because we assumed it was necessary to the plot?
But I also think it speaks to, that's a really good example of it done in a way that intentional. I think it speaks to lived experience too, and like people telling stories when they don't have lived experience of that particular story. Like Michaela Coel had lived experience, and that's why she was able to tell that story.
That has nuance and it has grey.
Yeah, the fear for me is that the way that Hollywood and like the film industry and movies and everything has typically shown violence and abuse is very sensational, to the point where it's almost like sexualized. Like, it's for some type of sexual gratification. It is so risky. That's why I May Destroy You was so phenomenal and transformative, because that whole story top to bottom was done in a way that if a victim survivor was watching that, they wouldn't be re-traumatized. What I'm trying to get at is, like, I really appreciate that that Ida's role has had this ripple effect, because I think that intention has been missing for a long time in storytelling, in films.
Exactly. Like, you start with just, we want to check in that an individual is okay. And then as soon as you take that moment, you start realizing all of the other strings that are attached to any representation of any person, you know, and all of the things that sort of pile up on that, because society, you know, one person doesn't live in a vacuum. I think that that's really the summary for this discussion, right? Like, the intention matters.
Yeah, just have a shred of intention. Come on. I mean, I'm speaking like I'm a filmmaking expert, but like, I watched this shit. I think it's so obvious.
No, but this is the thing, right? Like, the reason we're having this conversation is because we've noticed the lack. And if we're sitting here as two queer women who've noticed the lack in our very narrow scope of experience, then I'm absolutely sure that people from other backgrounds and other creeds and religions and races and countries and everything else have noticed the lack of intention when their stories are told.
And I'm sure there's absolutely nuance to this. I just think it's like that classic thing of reckoning with it a bit more.
Well, this is the beginning. This is the very beginning, because we're still so new. Like, Ida developed the guidelines like in 2017. We're not even talking a decade yet of this existing. Like, it's so new, and the ripples have already been felt so far, and the incredible work that she's done and people who have started to work in this space have done has been felt so massively that it just shows the incredible potential that it has to continue to change and shape how we make film and theatre.
Absolutely. And now that we know, we can ask those questions as well.
And we can make film and theatre. Are you ready to do a play?
If we have an intimacy coordinator, I will be. And if it's a story that we are meant to tell, sign me up.
Okay. Well, I've decided that we're going to make a biopic of your life.
Oh, please, God, no. Speaking of boundaries, it's a no from me. Let's not make that.
Well, that's a shame. I think all of us were really excited for a moment there. I read that you have a motto that you've used, which is, your no is a gift, tell us your no so we can trust your yes. And I'd love if you could talk a bit about that.
The intention always is that the actor can feel personally comfortable, so artistically that they can really be free and open and give their all, and both that they know that they're happy and comfortable, but also that their partner. So it's really important, tell us what's not okay, you know, around touch, tell us where your no-go areas are, and take responsibility for yourself to really consider what is okay for me. You know, the times that we ask someone, you know, what's okay, and they go, oh, do you know what? I haven't ever thought about that. I'll have to take some time. So becoming self-aware, getting embodied so that you can body listen. That's a big shift in the industry, where before it was, if anybody said no in any way, shape or form, they absolutely would be considered a troublemaker, a bit of a pain in the ass, or a diva. And they absolutely would be concerned that they would lose their job, or they wouldn't be invited back because they were, you know, considered to be a difficult actor. Whereas actually it's the other way around, in a process that invites your boundaries, and like I say, we're saying, tell us your no so that we can trust your yes. If anybody's interested in the work and wants to get in contact, please do so via the website, which is intimacyonset.com. Go to the contacts page and you can contact me there. Any responses or thoughts, we'd be delighted to hear from you. Other than that, I just want to say to you, Rosalind, and everybody who's working with you, that it's just been a delight to share this work with you. Thank you for your interest, and it's just been an absolute pleasure.
Thank thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Bad Behavior. I loved talking to Ida O'Brien about all of this stuff. I could literally talk for 3,500 years. In fact, if in another life I could choose another profession, another vocation, another job, I would be an intimacy coordinator. 100%. It's so intriguing. It's so interesting.
I want to know if Bridgerton had an intimacy coordinator.
Ooh, should I look it up?
With their first season as well, like,
there was Lizzie Talbot.
See? And you could tell. You could absolutely tell because
yeah,
those scenes were banging. They were fucking great. Like, goddamn. Mm-hmm.
Do you think I should be an intimacy coordinator? Should I change my profession?
I think you should. I am all for people having many different chapters of their life with different things that they're doing. I think you should start looking into it.
I think I'd be good at it.
I don't think I'd be very good at it because, I don't know, I think I'm too much of a perv to be good at it. Like, I'd just be like too, yeah, it wouldn't be, I'd lose that intention, you know?
Well, this is the thing, like, maybe there are people who are really looking for, like, maybe they're looking for the gays, you know? Like,
yes.
Maybe someone out there is like,
yes,
we need a bit of a queer perspective intimacy coordinator who's also, like, a fun, fresh, flirty woman.
100%. Lesbian sex scenes have a long way to go, I reckon, on TV.
Well, have you seen Gentleman Jack? Because Ida did that and she did a lot of research into it and it was genuinely one of the best sex scenes.
Oh, okay. I will watch that. I will absolutely watch it because I'm all for a great gay sex scene, as we've previously discussed. But I think you should absolutely add it to the list of things that you look into at some point when you feel like it, because it is such a good, cool, interesting job. I just think I'd struggle being around, like, really hot, famous people and having to tell them, like, put your hand on her breast in this angle. Like, I just, it would get to me. I'd be getting
nervous.
It
wouldn't be put it on this angle. It would be like, what are you comfortable doing? Okay, how can we choreograph that into this scene? You know, where is your weight distributed so that you're feeling like you have control of
this
moment?
That's true.
Like,
yeah, I mean, look, did I fundamentally just mischaracterize the meaning of intimacy coordination? Yes. But what I mean to say is that famous people make me nervous.
Yeah, and I don't think I'd have a problem with that. I feel like I would be like, yeah, okay, cool. They're famous. Now let's get cracking.
Yeah. Oh my God, do it then, please.
Okay, great. Well, next episode, we'll be talking about my journey to
intimacy coordination.
Yeah.
But seriously.
So exciting.
Go chat to your local intimacy coordinator. Check in with them. See how they're doing. Do you know what, though, too? I have a good question that I think we can end the episode on. Send us your favorite sex scenes. I want to know what your favorite sex scenes are. So send us a DM with your favorite sex scenes.
Oh, I am so ready. I want to watch a compilation of our listeners' favorite sex scenes.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
Thanks so much for listening. We love you so much and we will see you on the next
one. Bye.
Bad Behavior is a proud podcast with Diamantina Media. This episode's executive producer was Rosalind Anketel. Hosted by Rosalind Anketel and Nicola Cranage. Editing and sound design by Namcheja Magembe. Produced by Rosalind Anketel, Nicola Cranage, and Namcheja Magembe. Our logo was designed by Bonnie Eichelberger.
We all misbehave sometimes. Wanna change the world, indulge in some bad behavior.